Hello and welcome to White Line Wireless's continuing series on the Australian Imperial Force 11. My name is Anthony Condon and joining me today again is Krish Prasad.
Hello Anthony, how are you today?
Hello Krish, I'm very, very good. So after our last episode got cut short by the eviction of the Box of Dreams, the Box of Dreams has managed to relocate, and if it does sound a little bit roomy this episode, I do apologise. We are doing the best that we can.
So you're in a rather roomy dimension as opposed to the more compact dimension that we shot the previous episode in.
Yes, the Box of Dreams, it's TARDIS'd a bit, gotten bigger. So that is why the sound is doing what it's doing. So for those of you who don't know what's going on, go listen to the first couple. That will explain it. And a refresher for everyone else, what we're doing here is we are going through and reading the tour diary of Cow Corner. Now, a tour diary, it's not a personal diary, and it's not a series of match reports. It's supposed to be written to be published publicly in a newspaper, and, you know, it's kind of like the embedded journalist of the cricket team. But Cow Corner never existed as a real person, so I have taken a bunch of newspaper articles and put them together and made this fictionalized account. So these words were never written in this specific order by one specific person. They were written by many people, and I've tried to stitch them together into a coherent narrative. And that's what we've got. So then on the website, you can find all the places where I've taken this from. So when there's a quote and you scroll over it, the newspaper article I've taken it from will pop up. All the Australian articles, you can actually click through and read the full article. And that way you can decide whether or not I have done a fair reading of what happens and whether or not my biases that I've put in are correct or wrong and all that kind of thing. So we have a rather interesting week this week, and we're going to talk about some extended issues later in the podcast. But what we'll do first is we'll jump straight into Cow Corner's diary. And this week I've actually opened the blog post on anthonycondon.com with a picture that I have got out of a newspaper that hopefully by the time this is out I'll have referenced properly, and so it shows some pictures of the guys and the people that the players and the people that are hosting them on this leg of the tour, and a lot many more photos on the website embedded into the diaries if you go and have a look. So here's Cow Corner's tour diary for the 10th of August 1919. Unfortunately, our planned brief tour in Ireland, with two or three matches interspersed, fell through. Owing to our host, Sir Stanley Cochrane, well known in connection with that innocuous beverage ginger ale, having to leave Ireland for America on important business. The AIF 11 were billed to pay the Woodbrook Cricket Club at Sir Stanley's ground at his estate in Bray, with a second game against the Gentlemen of Ireland. This is possibly fortunate, given all the discontent and trouble going on over there at present. Actually, I think this is the point to probably do the wider discussion in this podcast, given it's about this stuff. So, yes, Stanley Cochrane, his dad invented ginger ale. Mm. And so the Cochrane family fortune is they're ginger ale magnates. And he was really, really trying to get cricket going in Ireland. And so here, out at his estate, he built the Woodbrook Cricket Club. You can still see the original, one of the original pavilions is still available out there. And hopefully I should have a photo on that on the website by the time this gets out. I'm just waiting to get some permission to use some photos. But it's a golf club out there now.
If you have some listeners from Ireland, feel free to walk over, take a photograph and show it to us.
And yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you what, if you in the UK and you're listening to this, and at any time you see something and it reminds you of something we've talked about in this, absolutely, I'd love to see photos of that. There have been a number of people who have already done that for me, taking photos of some of the war memorials and that kind of thing. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but you will get my acknowledgements in my thesis. So, that's really great. So he builds this cricket ground out at his house, and the big famous thing was he really, really tried to get the Australia-South Africa match during the triangular tournament played out there, and it ended up that no one would agree to it, so it didn't get played there. But Australia would on most tours play a match out there.
That would be one of the big what ifs during the course of this tour. Imagine if a match like that had happened in Ireland, where the future of cricket in Ireland would have been.
Yeah,
Ireland are a fairly decent squad. They are a associate member of the ICC.
Test nation now.
Yeah, they are a full test nation.
Yeah, that's happened this year when Afghanistan and Ireland got let in at the same time.
It should be.
They've played their first test series, I believe, Afghanistan and Ireland. So yeah,
it would be fantastic if we had more associate members of or people who are only qualified for T20. I think. We'll play more 50 overs international cricket. I think the World Cup would suitably benefit from that.
Yeah, and without going into it in too much detail, I think the World Cup needs to be a few more teams, and the T20 World Cup can keep getting bigger and bigger, I think. And and that's sort of how we should be funneling cricket around the world into better improvement. But that's a discussion for another podcast, that's for sure.
Yeah.
However, it is a really interesting place to talk about Ireland and Irish cricket and why they are where they are. You know, then like it's an Irishman does captain England, so So what's happened at this time? So he tried to get this game out in 1912. That's pretty much the end. Not getting that game is pretty much the end of cricket in Ireland, because it's, you know, not long later the war breaks out and things get put off. But it was 1912 was essentially the last time cricket was played at that ground, and then he was like, "Well, it's the MCC don't want to help me.
There's not enough interest and not enough support.
There's not enough support. The MCC don't want to help me. So what's the point? I'll turn it into a golf course." Now the other thing is that in 1906 or so, I believe, first 10 years of the century, the Gaelic Athletics Association, which of course are responsible for hurling and Gaelic football and some of the other Irish sports, they brought in a ban on cricketers. So if you played cricket, you got kicked out of the Gaelic Athletics Association, and that meant you couldn't. So if you wanted to play cricket, you couldn't play Gaelic football, you couldn't play hurling.
So strange exclusionary thing, but I suppose there was some logic behind this.
Yeah, the English sports.
Ah.
And so, which brings us on to the context of the episode. What is going on in Ireland at the moment?
It's a cultural conflict almost. Cricket is playing that role.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that's why cricket got banned. It's because it's this symbol of English oppression. So in 1916, you have Easter Uprising. And, that's the first sort of shot in the Irish War of Independence. And then at the start of 1919... You have the UK elections earlier on in the year that we're talking about, and Sinn Féin win the biggest they win the most number of seats out of Ireland, and instead of going over to House of Commons and sitting in Parliament in England, they just declare independence and refuse to sit, and so that kicks off what becomes known as the Irish War of Independence.
That would be 1919,
right now.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's going on now. Now, here's where I went on one of my little interesting tangents in this research, because I was like, why did they not go to Ireland? And this stuff with Stanley Cochran having to go to America on business, that's not mentioned in any other history on this tour. That is this tiny little article that I found right at the bottom of a page. The one I've actually sourced on the website was a little bit bigger, because I found that's the one. I did find a little bit better one. It's something that's kind of was unknown to the cricket historians. But it still didn't sit right with me. Why would you cancel your match against the Gentlemen of Ireland as well? That was supposed to be played.
Even the reason seems fairly flimsy, really.
Yeah, and so the game at Woodbrook at Cochrane's place was supposed. So Cochran had this massive, like a show kind of thing. Flower, best cucumber, all that kind of stuff that you have at agricultural shows. And that went ahead, even though he wasn't there. And he actually won. He won some prizes at that show. It's quite funny. One article I read, it was sort of like all more his housekeeper did. And it's like, admitting that he had nothing to do with the growing of those vegetables. He just stuck his name on it at the end. But anyway, so why didn't they go? And so then it was a matter of going in and finding out, okay, when's the first mention of this Irish tour being cancelled? Because the newspapers, so I can find in newspapers days before this tour. Like so in the last couple of days, so we're 10th to 17th of August this week. So, you know, on like the 7th or 8th of August, there's a schedule printed in England saying that these games are happening next week. Now that was where I went, okay, maybe they just didn't know and they're just printing an old fixture. That's obviously what happened. But the earliest I can find any sort of mention that they're not going was their last trip to Scotland. And that was the start of July. So I think the article where they mentioned that they're not going, that they're going to be coming back to Scotland is the 2nd of July.
Right.
Now, the signing of the Treaty of Versailles is the 28th of June. And one of the big parts about the signing of the Treaty of Versailles was that all the nations who signed, there was this sort of agreed borders thing. And so if anyone invaded anyone else's borders. I'm not 100% sure if this is League of Nations as well. Quite possibly.
Possibly
is.
It is a League of Nations.
Yeah, I think it happens at the same time.
Yeah.
So one of the things is that, okay, so we're going to recognise everyone's borders and defend them. And Ireland was lobbying really, really hard. They'd sent heaps of people over to the US to lobby the US. They, you know, had people in France lobbying everyone there, trying really, really hard to get recognition, because if they get recognition in this treaty, then all of a sudden the English have to get out of Ireland.
And, otherwise, you know, they face
everyone's gonna,
everybody else will be
That's the treaty will say that everyone has to come to Ireland's aid and defend their borders.
Compulsorily against England.
Yeah, and, you know, Ireland's been occupied for 800 odd years at this point. And
it's so a smart political move, yes.
Really, really is. And it nearly happens, and it's right up to the moment when, and it doesn't end up happening. So Ireland remain part of the United Kingdom. And so I was thinking, were there some riots or some strikes or something like that in the lead up to this tour being cancelled? And I couldn't find anything.
Well, a suitably violent event to say that it's a security risk and therefore we shall not be going ahead with it. But yeah, like you said, there's not any proof.
There wasn't any particular event.
Yeah.
You know, like if there'd been a big protest in response to the signing of Treaty of Versailles, that would have been like, okay, yep, you can see it's a security issue.
Yeah, it's a volatile situation.
We don't want to go, so we're not going to do that. And then I started thinking, okay, so I wonder what the deal with Australian soldiers in the IRA were. And there's very little written on it. And I found a thesis, and without going into the full story, there were actually Australian soldiers who would go AWOL and fight with the IRA. But the Australian military destroyed all records of that. There is no records of any Australian going AWOL and joining the IRA. And there is records of Kiwis doing it. And if Kiwis did it, Australians definitely did it. And there were a lot more Australians. So it makes no sense that they don't exist.
It might reflect poorly on the conduct of the Australian military, and therefore was it one of the reasons why those sort of incidences were stricken from record, or at least completely whitewashed?
Quite possibly. I haven't read the thesis where this is all spoken about in great detail, so I'm not 100% sure. But I think it was a matter of embarrassment. But this is a period of very heightened sectarian unrest in Australia.
Yes.
You know, this conscription debate is largely an Irish English fight. It's largely Catholic Protestant fight. It's very much played out around those lines. There is a lot of concern in Australia about people giving too much identification towards Irish independence. But then at the same time, there is an argument in Australia where a lot of people are going, just make them a dominion like us and Canada and South Africa. Like, so Ireland doesn't even have that status at that point. You know, they're part of the United Kingdom. They get to elect members of parliament, but there is Australia is very, very big on this at the time of home rule and not just
sovereignty.
Sovereignty, you know, people get to rule themselves, and there's a very strong feeling that there is an Irish identity that isn't English in Australia, and that exists. And then I found this great little story of this one guy who, in the signing of the night at the signing of the Treaty of Versailles, 28th of June, he gets arrested because and court-martialed because he was found out marching with it was a spontaneous demonstration of Sinn Feiners. And so he's out there in his dress uniform with his slouch hat on with the Sinn Féin badge on his chest going, up the Sinn Féin, up the Sinn Féin.
Yeah, optics-wise, that's not really a good look for the Australian military at the time.
Yeah, because they are part of the English military and they're over, and these people are currently at war with England. And so, yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation. And then it turns out when you go and read through his transcripts and stuff, so his reasoning was that he was just out on the town in Ireland getting pissed with some local boys. And then all of a sudden, they're out shouting in the streets, having a great time. And so he's not a terrorist. He's a backpacker.
In many ways, it's the kind of excuse that lives on to this day. I was just on the booze, mate.
And, you know, like I'm sure many of us have travelled the world in our youth, in our early 20s, and know what it's like to be a stranger in a strange town. And you're getting, you know, you find a bunch of locals to get in with and you get drunk and, man, you're going to go along with anything, aren't you? It's just a good time.
Yeah, you want to fit in.
Just a good time. So there was that story. So I think there's two plausible explanations as to why the Tour of Ireland gets cancelled. And the first is they were worried about defection. You know, so, but there's only three Catholics in the side. So I don't think that, and I was nearly going to write a line in the diary about that, but I didn't because it wouldn't have worked. It was breaking the whole historical narrative too much. So I don't know whether it would have been worried about defection so much as I think they were really worried that a game between Australia and the Gentlemen of Ireland would become a symbolic thing and had the potential to really be a flashpoint, because I know a lot of the Irish and the Sinn Féiners, so the Irish nationalists and people who are wanting home rule were very interested in getting Australia's support.
Yeah.
So I can see how they would have gone down there.
That does make sense.
Yeah.
You would think that they would like to get a friendly voice on their side.
Indeed.
And as we know, sport is a very, very good way for countries to establish soft power.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's very much what sport's about. You know, we had a couple of weeks ago talking about the Allied Games. That was very much about that. This whole tour is about, you know, providing a fillip to the mother country and promoting the sport. And, you know, it's one of the things I wanted to talk about last week and the week before that I kind of kept missing, but, you know, it's a great place of cultural transfer. This is how people really learn about each other. So that's really common.
Yeah, we saw that with the marriages happening between the Australian players. And
And, you know, Crawford travelling around to all those countries. So I think it could have been this flashpoint, and they were quite worried about that. And that got me thinking about a few things. And one of the players...
So before you get onto that, we were talking about cultural exchange. I mean, that cultural exchange is never just one way.
No. And that's and it's interesting you say that because, you know, that's a big thing in history at the moment. You know, people that realization that cultural exchange doesn't go one way. And also within empire studies as well, realizing that the cultural exchange isn't just between England and the colonies.
Yeah.
It's between the colonies as well.
Maybe the perception at that point was that you don't want to have these feelings of any sort of the Irish nationalism, quote, infecting the people.
Yeah, so, you know, those kind of, getting into those, having those political discussions, or, you know, the soldiers go, this team going over there and seeing stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
Because by this stage, leave in Ireland had been cancelled, so they were no longer sending soldiers on leave. It was a very common place to go on leave, and a lot of them, I found out this in my research, a lot of them would go over there and not join the IRA, but a lot of them were going over there and selling their guns, because you kept your gun with you when you went on leave. And so that's where a lot of the early arms for the IRA come from. But in reading it, I read this thing, and they set up this role of a provost marshal in Ireland, which they hadn't been at till that point. And he's the head of the military police.
Mm.
And then I was thinking, hang on, so one of our players is a provost marshal.
Is this from the AIF 11?
So Ted Long, who is still, I'm pretty sure he's still touring with the team. But he was the first of the wicket keepers.
Mm.
And so now he's been superseded by Oldfield, but I'm pretty sure he's still in the team. And so, I'm talking a bit out of school here. I haven't done the research to be able to prove all this, but the provost were very much, they were the spies head of the military police. So the military police. And you know, it sort of makes me think. I wonder if that's one of the reasons, maybe, why Ted Long was on the tour, and he's embedded. And
it's a bit insidious.
It is. And so, you know, that's my tinfoil hat take on it. But anyway, so they don't go to Ireland for a reason that we don't have any explanation for. The official reason is because their host has gone to America.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it seems like there was probably some concern about the team being there. And either players defecting, but I think probably more likely about the cricket match becoming a sparking point for what was a quite tense situation. And indeed, in 1921, there is an IRA attack on a cricket match that's between a garrison and a county side. So, you know, the aristocrats versus the soldiers, and someone ends up being...
Yeah, the IRA have no sympathy for either of those.
On that, no, very much no. Could go on and on about the Irish War of Independence, and I think I might do one of the bonus travel podcasts on that, because I think it's one of those things when we think about 1919 that gets lost a lot.
It definitely does. In the course of this podcast, especially this particular game, you'll find that it's fairly one-sided. The cricket in general is just it's a thing that's driving the story, but not really the main part of the story. The main part of the story is the idea of bringing cricket, using cricket, pardon, to bring back some sort of normalcy to a post-war ravaged world. But in most cases, just like we saw at the end of Tolkien's trilogy, the place that you leave doesn't really attain that same state of normalcy ever again, especially after such a traumatic event like a world war.
Yeah.
There's no going back.
Mm.
This is just a ploy. Ploy just sounds like a bad word, but like an idea to use cricket to achieve some level of...
return to the old world. Yeah. And we've spoken about that before, that there were a lot of people that like, we can never go back.
Mm.
And there were a lot of people like, yeah, I think we can go back. And then there are people who are like, well, we can't go back. But it doesn't mean we can't go back to life being good.
Of course.
And just to like one last thing on the Irish stuff, that obviously my sources being almost entirely coming from cricket journalists, there was definitely a big bias in that. Not just in the people, but also in what they write about, what they select to write about, what they choose as important issues.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is not really what they select to write about, but rather what they select to omit.
Yeah. And that's one of the big things we have to do in history, is try and read in those gaps and make some sort of, a lot of historians don't like it, but I think it's important to make some sort of guess at what goes on there and then back up why you think like that.
Because, a synthesis would be a better word to use there. Right?
Yeah, and what you know, and just to... But, you know, back it up so we can have a discussion about the guests. So, anyway, let's go back to Cow Corner and end that tangent. Our delightful host in Scotland was Mr. Peter Dawson. Did I mention that? That's right. So they go to Scotland instead. Our delightful host in Scotland was Mr. Peter Dawson, the manufacturer of Dawson's Whiskey, who arranged a most comprehensive motor tour for 2 weeks through the beauties of Scotland, including the Trossachs, the Lochs, and even as far north in the Highlands as Inverness. Following a visit to the famous shipbuilding yard of Messrs. Denny and Company Limited in Dumbarton, where we all had the pleasure of going over the latest submarines, we attended a garden party at the grounds of the Pollock Cricket Club at Shoreholme. We were also guests of the Duke of Atholl at Blair Atholl Castle, who personally conducted us around his historic residence, pointing out all its most notable features. So this week was really, this really was a holiday.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. This is a patronage tour.
Yeah.
They're just being taken at the most exotic locations in the country, yeah. Visiting the best places.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I suppose it is in the best interest of their hosts to provide a most favorable experience, especially because it juxtaposes it with their experiences in Ireland previously. Messrs. Denny and Co. in Dumbarton
making submarines
would have been a very profitable enterprise during the war. I suppose Messrs. Denny and Co. became quite rich at the end.
Quite probably. I haven't followed that up, but yes, you would imagine so. So, very much a social tour, this one. You know, they're going to garden parties, they're looking at the latest industrialists and hanging out with the aristocrats. So let's see what Cow Corner has to tell about the rest of the tour. Of course, it wasn't all locks and whiskey. Most of our time in Scotland was taken up by sightseeing, but a couple of one-day matches were fixed up. The first against Greenock at Glen Park. It could be Greenock, I have no idea. The highlight of which was Murray's 50-minute century, made up of 4 sixes and 10 fours. A century by our host, Mr. Kerr, to go along with his 5 wickets for 62, and Collins mopping up 8 Greenock wickets at a cost of only 39 runs.
Yeah, Collins, once again, at the forefront of the bowling figures. That particular innings by Murray, 4 sixes and 10 fours, it's almost an innings out of the Adam Gilchrist playbook.
Yeah, just going out and slogging around at it all. So I'm just going to quickly get a scorecard here. All right, so Australians versus Greenock, the one-day games. And of course, a one-day game just means that there's one day. You usually only play an innings each, and you can call it complete, but it's not like there's limited overs or anything like that at this stage.
Yeah. A fair shuffle of the batting order, once again, with Docker and Murray opening the innings. Docker bowled cheaply for 5. But Murray, the standout in this first innings by the Australians, scoring 121 out of the 284 total. Decent partnerships with Bull and Whiting further down the order. And Trenary at the end scoring 32 with, I'm hoping, a few lusty blows.
Yeah, I think this entire innings was lusty blows.
I would believe so.
They made 284 runs. And it's a one-day game.
Yeah, which by the way is a decent total even now in one-day internationals. However, there is no count of the number of overs that were bowled.
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, this is one of my least complete scorecards. I am actually just relying on a scorecard published in the paper at the time. So I have very little of information on this.
But imagine if this was 50 overs. I mean, that's a lot of hitting.
Mm.
Greenock, in response, were mostly... Their entire innings is just the opening partnership between Kerr and Walker. Kerr scoring 103, Walker scoring 48, and the rest of the innings is just us. 1-2-0-0-0. Zero, that's not a telephone number. 14, 3, and 6, and game bowled out for 183, Greenock.
I would really love to have the fall of wickets on this one to know.
Oh, it'll be a procession, that one.
Yeah, yeah, look, so I wonder if, like, Kerr and Walker, you know, they go out there and they start, and they both sort of get to their 50s. Walker goes out at 48, and then it's just this absolute, no one stays with Kerr, so he must have just started going bananas.
Absolutely. Just,
he's like, he knows that none of these dudes can bat. He's the only cricketer in the region because he took the 5 wickets as well. So he did all the work on that side as well.
Complete all-around performance by Kerr.
Yeah, five for 62 in a century. That's not bad. Against the Australians are a first-class side. Mm. So that's, yeah. But Greenock definitely weren't. So that's the Greenock game.
8 wickets for Collins, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, 8 wickets.
Yep. So
I think that the Green Egg batsman must have been sick of the sight of him.
So I just want to point out that Kerr, who did all the run scoring, was bowled by Pelu.
Who was a part-time bowler.
Yeah, part-time. Well, I don't really recall Pelu having... He has, but it's not something I can really think of any decent innings he's had. So definitely the shit getting wickets in that regard.
I would like to think of Nip Pelu bowling his dibbly-dobblies.
Yes.
You know, I'm a big fan of the dibbly-dobbly.
The dibbly-dobbly, yep. Yep. So, and I also just want to point out, so Cameron, who's playing... We haven't heard of Cameron yet. He was... he only plays this one game for Australia and just gets brought in. But we can talk a little bit about... We should go back to Cow Corner because Cow Corner has more to add. That's about all there was about from Greenock. The second match was against a team of 15 representing the north of Scotland at Inverness, who were not expected that they would make much of a stand against the Australians. Their bowling and their fielding, 12 men took the field, proved quite satisfactory. That's the Australians bowling and fielding. So I don't know if 12 men took the field for Australia. They only 12 batted, but I think 12 fielded from what I can tell.
There'll be some nice new fielding positions with 12 players. I wonder how they would be distributed across the field.
Well, in the north of Scotland have 15 on the field.
Yeah, I mean, a number of slips that you would put up, but that's assuming you have good bowling attack. Otherwise, it's just asking for trouble.
Yeah. I think what would have happened is they would have fielded 12 for Australia. And then I think when you're playing against the odds matches, 12 would have fielded for the north of Scotland, but 15 would have batted. Yeah,
okay.
I think that's how it worked because you play 22s as well, and I can't imagine having 22 fielders. That would be nuts. You're playing 11 slips.
You know? I mean, I would want to watch it. Yeah. It would not be great to play, but I would like to watch that.
You're not finding the gaps. It's like, you know.
Oh, there are no gaps.
You're going over the top.
Oh, yeah.
You're scoring in sixes or not.
Mm.
Yes, proved quite satisfactory. It was when the North men went to the wicket that the real difference between the teams became apparent. The bowling of Collins and Winning did not give the North men a chance of settling down to make a score. Clever and resourceful bowling was supplemented by the smartest of fielding, and the North 15 were all out for 36.
That's just stunning.
Yeah, so they're 36 in response to, because I don't have the Australian score there, just quickly jump over that scorecard. We won't go through it now. But they're 36 chasing 196 in a one-day game. So they weren't supposed to play a second innings. But as Cal Corner tells us, as there was still an hour to go, the Australians went to the wicket a second time. Their batting was then in the nature of an exhibition such as is seldom seen in the north of Scotland. Free batting all round the field was the order of the evening. In 35 minutes, the score had passed the 100 mark. Sixes were hit by Docker, Murray and Bull, and they and Ernie Cameron, who carried his bat, had 146 runs to their combined credit. The Australians' batting roused the spectators to enthusiasm, and it may be expected that the visit will have an encouraging effect on the game in the north.
I think this is one of those reasons why... A style of game like T20 is very important for cricket.
It'll make it more
attractive for first-time viewers.
Absolutely, obviously. Absolutely.
There is this sort of this strange sort of elitist mentality when it comes to cricket where people talk
it's
about...
It's not even that strange. It is,
I am also guilty
one of the defining points of cricket.
I am also guilty that I'm one of those test match elitist snobs.
I'm a test match snob, absolutely.
But I still love
T20.
Exactly. Something has to be said about making the game more... Palatable is probably not the right word, but attractive.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, say what you want about T20. It is attractive cricket. It's attractive attacking cricket for the most part.
I think the big thing about the T20 is that someone who has never watched cricket before can come and watch a T20 match, and they probably won't know what's going on a lot of the time, why that person just went out, you know, but won't understand, you know, LBW or anything like that. But they will understand big hit.
Yeah.
Runs scored.
They'll really understand when the crowd cheers.
Yeah.
And crowd interaction is much higher in T20. For instance, I had an experience. I went to the New Year's Big Bash last year at the MCG.
Mm.
90,000 people.
Mm, it's a great game.
An absolute carnival atmosphere.
Mm.
I was also there in December for the Boxing Day Test match between India and Australia. I was very happy in that particular stand. Mm. But for the most part, it was desolate.
Mm.
The idea of T20 cricket being the forebear for pulling cricket, kicking and screaming into
Vanguard,
the...
yes.
Yes, just I think it's very necessary. And there is context because a one-day game in 1919 is very equivalent to a T20 game now, or rather a T10 game, which we might be seeing soon too. But
well, we've spoken about the Sixers tournaments.
Yeah, the Hong Kong Sixers. Yeah. I mean, they used to be quite common. Six overs. Yeah. In this particular game, scoring 135 minutes or so, that's I believe, what, like 7-8 overs? That's less than 10 overs.
Yeah, probably would have been, yeah.
And I would presume, I'm not sure if this is true now.
No, you would have got more than 10 out of an hour. You get about, this stage, you get about
It wasn't an hour, it was 35 minutes.
Oh, 35 minutes. Yeah, no, yeah, so you're right. It would be like 6,
I would presume
overs.
It would be an 8-ball over at this point.
No, there a lot of 6-ball overs in general. No 8-ball, the presume they play the 4-ball? No, it might be the 8-ball in England at this stage.
Okay, but even then, it's an immense scoring rate. And it's clearly there just to send the crowd home happy.
Yeah.
Because if a game ends an hour early, it ends an hour early.
Yeah.
But this game is bigger than just a cricket match. This is there to make the game more like increase the appeal of the game to a place like Scotland.
The nature of an exhibition such as seldom seen in the north of Scotland.
That's so a great line.
You know, they never get up there.
Absolutely not.
None of the big teams ever get up there. So, you know, these guys are on holiday, so they go out. And I just love that Ernie Cameron carries his bat through this. Because Cal Corner's about to tell us about Ernie Cameron. But Ernie Cameron played in that Greenock game, but hasn't played at all on the tour, but he has been around. But let's go talk to Cal Corner about Ernie Cameron. Ernie Cameron, the Essendon footballer, has been the moving force behind the scenes on the tour, and his personality has been a big factor in making the AIF team the happy family that has been so much lauded. One of the selectors for the tour, along with Barber and Park, Ernie has taken up the management position from Howard Lacey. He is a glad, open-hearted, unselfish sportsman, an ideal character for a manager of men.
Ernie Cameron sounds like the prototypical Aussie rules footballer, does he?
Yeah. So he's just taken over the management and he's going to manage the tour all for the rest of the time now.
There was no such thing as support staff back in the day, was it?
So on a tour, you would take a manager and a secretary.
Mm.
And so it was the manager's job to, things like making sure everyone's got a train ticket, you know, getting everyone booked into
logistics,
the hotel, all of that stuff. And then the secretary's job was money.
Mm.
So, you know, making sure they had all the receipts and things like that. And I think we spoke about it in an earlier week when we were talking about some of those disputes in the 10 years prior to this. And one of the things that got the Australian Border Control into saying, look, we need to start picking who does this, is that one of the secretaries comes back with, I don't know if you've seen Black Books and you know of Bernard Black's suit coat of receipts, but it sounds like he kind of came back with that and said, here you go, here is my documentation for the tour.
Any show with Dylan Moran and Bill Bailey is fine by me.
Yeah, I love both of them. Ernie Cameron, Essendon footballer. I got a picture of him here. I've got his footy card. There you go. That's Ernie Cameron. You can see that on the website, anthonycondon.com.
I would assume he achieved much more acclaim as a footballer than a cricketer.
Yeah, he was a much more famous footballer. And he played for Essendon. Won their premiership with them in 1911, and was best and fairest for 11 and 12. He won a premiership, debuts at 17, wins a premiership, gets best and fairest 2 years running, and then breaks his leg really, really badly, and then the war kicks off, and he never plays football again. So that's, Ernie Cameron's story, probably not that well known in Australian rules football, and probably should be more well known. But one of those guys whose career is just a much, much shorter than it ever should have been. Played 114 games over 7 years, but retired at just 23 years old. So a little bit more from Cow Corner. There was some other news regarding our fixtures this week. Firstly, the AIF boys will play a South of England at Portsmouth and not Hampshire, as originally arranged. This is high praise for the quality of the team, and a chance for us to prove our mettle after the defeat to the gentlemen of England. It has also been announced that the South African Cricket Association has requested the High Commissioner in London to negotiate a visit to South Africa. A couple of really interesting things in that one. So firstly, so Hampshire game's been cancelled and they're going to play south of England. So that's a big deal. So the movers and shakers have said, you know, all right, let's give these guys
a proper challenge.
A proper challenge. Yeah. And so they've managed to get that. Because we've got this one gentleman of England game that they lost pretty badly. But, you know, you can lose a cricket game pretty badly, pretty easily. So now they're going to get a chance to play a South of England game, which has got, so the professionals. And so, yeah, so you have those in England at the time. You've got amateur and player games. So amateur, professional, gentlemen and players, so which is an amateurs and professionals. They're a big thing. Every county will have that. And then your rep team is the best of those two. And then there's a South of England and a North of England, and that's like the best reps. That's the best two from those two, and then that they will play a game every year as well.
The interesting thing is the note on which it ends that there is going to be a request by the South African Cricket Association for a tour as well. It ends on a cliffhanger. I'd be very curious to see where this goes.
Yeah. So and I just like that. I think this really it's a good representation of what's going on here. So to organise the tour, the South African Cricket Association has sent a telegram to the South African High Commissioner in London to go and negotiate a visit, assumedly with like Birdwood and stuff, like with the military authorities. So, you know, we've gone from this era where it's just dudes organising it themselves. We've gone through this big tussle over creating a representative body. South Africa's gone through something similar. England's gone through something similar. Everyone's thought this is a thing in cricket at the time.
Establishing all of these boards of control and taking, the control away from the individual grounds and or counties. And having
players.
A centralized hierarchy. Yeah.
Yeah, and here we see it's sort of all reaching its peak where this is government to government negotiations over a cricket tour.
Is this as high as cricket's reach has ever gotten? I suppose that there's not a lot of high commissions negotiating cricket tours anymore.
There might be an argument to say that. I mean, I imagine that there's some stuff in organising things like World Cups that would come through. And there's definitely got to be a few India-Pakistan stories that are way above this.
Well, there's one thing. I read recently that the Australian team is planning to play a test match in Pakistan at some point.
Oh, really? That'll be
next year. But I heard it was somewhere along the lines of they will land, play the game, and then immediately fly out to Dubai again once the game is done. I don't know how the logistics of that would actually work out, but honestly, it's been a while since I've seen like a good game play out at Karachi or Rawalpindi or Lahore. Like great stadium, pace on the wicket. It's fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to cricket getting back to Pakistan.
Oh, of course, 100%.
I'd love to go and watch cricket.
I would like to have some India-Pakistan bilateral series come out. I mean, it's been a long time. I mean, some of my best and worst moments in supporting the Indian cricket team has been watching those bilateral games. I mean, there was this one series I remember when like the first test it was in Chennai and Tendulkar made 130 odd and India ended up losing the game by only 13 runs or so. And then the Chennai crowd, they gave a standing ovation to the Pakistani team at the time. The next test was in Delhi and Anil Kumble picked up 10 wickets in innings. So two very, very...
10 wickets in an innings, geez.
Yeah, really interesting test matches. But I think after that, there has been no bilateral test matches after that.
Yeah, I did speak about this kind of stuff a little bit with Aman Misra, who's one of our White Line Wireless India correspondents, and so when I was over there, we talked about it a bit, and he was a great font of knowledge on the politics behind this, and because there's all the pitch destruction.
Yes,
and things
that
like
happened
that
in Mumbai
a couple of times. Twice,
in my
happened.
Home city. It's absurd.
Yeah, and some stories about like some high level negotiations going on,
really
like
high level
at Lords during World Cups and stuff like that, and there's been heaps of digital ink spilled over the importance.
I think at some point another cow corner type person will be covering the ramifications of the recommencement of India-Pakistan cricket. I think world cricket in general will benefit. from things like that.
And hopefully peace and prosperity in South Asia as well. You know,
we always hope.
Yeah, we always hope. Well, it's does sport, can you mix sport and politics?
Sport is politics.
Yes, that is. I'm definitely in your camp there. If you believe we shouldn't mix sport and politics, tweet at me at anthcondon.com and I can have we can have a great discussion as to why you're wrong. And but I think we're going to leave it there for this week, finishing up with the politics of India and Pakistan in our politics of Ireland and England episode. It's all been quite relevant and interesting, and I hope you've enjoyed it. That's all for us today. Thanks again for doing this, Krish. It's been great to have you on.
Thank you, Anthony. Always a pleasure.
And we will speak to you next week. Goodbye.
DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, call the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
Just one click to hear it all.
Boba, boba, bloody bo.
The main of every true blue fan is the Bandex cricketer anchorman. It's the same old words in the same old voice.
Bloody ball.